The Guardian.
The plane tilts, turning in a wide circle, engines roaring. She can imagine the pilot up in the cockpit, searching, searching, straining to see the tiny glimmers of torchlight, which mean that they are expected down there in the dark. A lamp comes on in the roof of the fuselage, a single, unblinking red eye. The dispatcher gives the thumbs up. He's found it!
Down the centre of the street march the bandsmen in braided maroon uniforms and gold-trimmed kippies, carrying their golden instruments. At first, we just heard the cries, not the words at that point, just the angry shouts, thrust forward through the melee of townspeople, men and women hollering and cursing. No hair, not just bareheaded, no hair. That made them seem utterly naked, just the gleaming domes of their skulls, whiteness of skin and bone where hair should be. All that was female ripped off them.
Good morning and welcome to day two of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. I'm Sarah Crown and we've just come from The Guardian's own event with Simon Moore and Michelle Roberts, who have very kindly agreed to join me for a second time here in the podcast tent now. Both of them have written books that were set in occupied France during the Second World War. Michelle's novel Ignorance tells the story of childhood friends Jean and Marie-Angèle, who grow up side by side in a village but whose fortunes diverge wildly over the course of the war. While Simon's book The Girl Who Fell from the Sky is the story of Marianne Sutro, who's a half-French, half-English girl who's recruited by special operations in the UK to go undercover in wartime France. And I started the event by asking them why they chose that place and that period to set their novels.
In my case, it was very much the story of the girl. There is, in the background of it, a real person. And I was just fascinated by the idea of the fact that girls of 19 years old were recruited and were thrown into France. Britain was completely detached from the continent, obviously, by the war. These women were recruited into what was essentially thought of as a man's job, and that fascinated me.
Well, the novel came from really several images that were haunting me, and that's how I write novels. I take what's haunting me and try and put things together and make something with them. So the process begins as visual rather than verbal. I'm sure you recognised that there was a photograph that I was describing. It's a very famous photograph of young women being paraded with shaved heads post-liberation to shame them. That haunted me for years. To it, I added visual images given to me by my mother, who died 4 years ago. And in her last years, when I visited her, she needed to tell stories over and over again about the war, which she had actually lived through in Wales, but her whole family had been in Normandy under the occupation. And my mother's stories were amazing because, repeated as they were never entire or whole stories. They concerned little tiny fragments, images. There was a basket of silver cutlery that got lost, stolen. There was a wedding sheet with a monogram on it. And they joined up with another image, which was simply a house I visited in northwest France, which haunted and enchanted me. And it really took possession of my imagination. And it then became peopled with two small girls who'd come in to visit this eccentric artist. And I wrote it very much to try and explore people's memories of the war, because all the people in my mother's family of her generation were obsessed with the war, and that's how they talked about time before the war, after the war.
Simon and Michelle, one of the things that I found really interesting about reading both of your books was that they explode the sort of cultural myths of heroes and villains that we come out of the war with. And I guess that in wartime it's very easy to cast people into those roles, but in both of your books it becomes clear over the period of the book that the notion's slightly bogus. And I wondered, you know, what sort of challenges that presented to you as writers and what opportunities.
I grew up very much with the first version of the war.
And the heroic version.
The heroic version, yes. And I think we've now got to the stage where we're looking to get the non-heroic version And that's partly what I was interested in, although I dare say you could think that my protagonist is a sort of heroine, but still I was trying to get across the normality, the fact that she was a 19-year-old girl.
Michelle?
One thing a novel can do is take a cliché or an oversimplified phrase and tease out something more complicated and, I think, more truthful. So heroes and villains, my novel is really trying to explore those words by looking at people on the ground, particularly the women who lived through the occupation in an unnamed, unspecified village in northwest France, and who all survived as best they could. So some people in the novel are very active collaborators, double dealers, betrayers, money makers, but they've got enough humanity or goodness that they might also occasionally do something decent to help Jews escape, for example. Other people who have acted as they think at the time, with integrity and honesty, after the war are perceived differently and labelled as villains. So I was as much interested in our perceptions of people as in the truth about what these fictional characters might or might not have done.
You mentioned the word betrayal there. This seems to me to be a very important word when we're talking about occupied France. And I think, again, we're coming back to the idea of sort of clichés. It's the thing that we anticipate in the behind-the-lines stories is that moment of betrayal when the person who you think has been on side and has been rooting for you and helping you actually then screws you over. It's clear-cut in your book, Simon, and more subtle in yours, Michelle, but I wondered how both of you had felt engaging with that.
Clear-cut in my book to a certain extent, because actually the reader doesn't know who the betrayers are. But of course, in the world of special operations, the issue of betrayal and not was, as you say, more clear-cut. They were in an enviable position in some ways, these people who went into occupied territories, because they were actually fighting on the side of a particular protagonist in the war. But the people with whom they worked, they had a very different sort of world around them. And often, I suppose, the special operations people actually put the civilian population in the position of having to make choices that otherwise they maybe would have been able to avoid. And actually making themselves very vulnerable as a result.
Well, I suppose that's one of the things that wartime does, isn't it? Is that it forces us to very cleanly choose one thing over another in a way that in sort of normal civilian life you get away without doing. And I guess that's where the notion of betrayal comes in your book, Michelle.
I think what my novel's doing is starting from a position under the occupation where there is an active encouragement for people to betray one another. For example, by informing on each other if they're hoarding food or selling it on the black market. Betrayal seems to shade into, possibly into collaboration, which in turn shades into survival. I think what a novel does is take these big abstract words and try and tell the stories that lie underneath them.
And what do you think the psychological effect of placing a community in that sort of position whereby they're being actively encouraged to dob each other in? What effect does that have on the population?
I think it has an effect of creating fear and suspicion and destroying the links of trust that might have existed in peacetime, to some extent, in an ordinary village, in an ordinary street, in an ordinary family. Possibly what's happening is the darker side of people is being brought out and manipulated by the occupiers.
And so for you, do you think that the sort of pivotal scene in the book, which you said was drawn from a photograph that's fairly widely known of these women being who are believed to have slept with Germans during occupation and they're paraded through the streets, do you think that that's then an act of healing for the community to say, you know, it's over now, we didn't do this and we're ostracising people whom we accuse of having done it?
Well, they might have wanted to call it healing. Of course, I think the women who were being paraded wouldn't have felt they were allowed to be part of the healing. They were being wounded by what happened to them. They were being scapegoated. I think that happens a lot in wars, that certain kinds of energies get sexualized. You can see it in the mass rape of women by male soldiers that goes on. I think there was a sexualization of France after the war. She becomes like the Virgin Mary, totally pure. She rises up, she's clean, nothing so-called dirty, i.e. sexy about her. France, to have that image of herself, it's a male image, had to get rid of undesirables. Well, what was going on in the war? Undesirables were got rid of. Jews, communists. It's shocking and terrible that happened at the liberation too, that the women who'd suffered in the war, some of whom had worked in brothels because of poverty. Why else do women go into brothels? They're poor. They don't do it because they think they're going to have multiple orgasms. They are punished. It's one of the most shameful episodes of the history just after the Second World War.
And France, of course, connived at the creation of this huge myth. And actually, de Gaulle oversaw the creation of this huge myth of resistance. When the liberation took place and de Gaulle marched into France behind the liberating armies, which he would have said were French, but of course were Anglo-American, he actually ordered all the SOE agents who had been operating with resistance groups, he ordered them out of the country and accused them of being mercenaries of a foreign power.
Goodness.
How about that?
And just one last quick question, since it's Sunday morning and it's probably at the top of everyone's minds. One of the signifiers that you use, both of you use throughout the novels, to indicate the deprivation to which France has been subjected under the war, is the absence of coffee. And I wondered why it was coffee in particular that you settled on.
Perhaps it's partly because in the memoirs that people wrote, they themselves mentioned coffee a great deal, because coffee is one of the great cultural signifiers in French life. And because food was so harshly rationed and there was very little of anything, bread, the staples of life, coffee was a staple of life, people had to become very inventive and make coffee substitutes. And maybe because taste is one of our most deep and primitive and primal ways of experiencing the world. It's the baby's perhaps first knowledge of the world is the taste of the breast, of milk. Coffee evokes through taste pleasure and bliss, but then of course utter deprivation.
Coffee in Britain is yes, okay, it's being consumed in large amounts, but it's a sort of add-on.
It's not the lifeblood.
I live in Italy and Michelle lives in France, and in both countries coffee is sort of fundamental.
From historical thrillers to a contemporary horror story, Louise Welsh's previous novels, The Bullet Trick, Naming the Bones and the award-winning The Cutting Room, established her as the leading light of Scottish noir, investigating the dark corners of her native Glasgow. But her new novel, The Girl on the Stairs, plays out entirely in an ominous, unfamiliar Berlin. The heroine Jane is a new arrival to the city, 7 months pregnant, lonely and jumpy, and suspecting foul deeds in the apartment next door. Zan Brooks asked her whether it was right to describe the novel as a haunted house story.
In some ways, a haunted house story that has no supernatural aspect, but is certainly centred on a couple of buildings, a very modern tenement in Berlin, or I should say a tenement with a veneer of modernity to it, and the house behind the back house, which is derelict. And Jane, who's at the centre of the book, is in a way haunted by her past. She is haunted by the idea of what might have happened in these buildings. So yes, it's and the book, of course, does draw on horror conventions or horror movie conventions, but there's nothing supernatural at all.
It's interesting you say that it's drawing on horror movie conventions, because the cover with the little figure with the red hood on it, which automatically evokes memories of Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now. But I was also, when I was reading it, I was thinking of Polanski, and I was thinking of specifically The Tenant and Repulsion and even Rosemary's Baby, and that the main character here is a pregnant woman.
Yeah, definitely. I've never seen The Tenant, but definitely Rosemary's Baby, Repulsion and Don't Look Now were all films that I've lived with for a long time, and I think that helped to prompt this particular book, along with, I guess, books like The Yellow Wallpaper, Henry James, The Turn of the Screw. And I suppose that, that idea of hesitation, what is around the corner, and we don't quite know what's around the corner. And with Jane, she is pregnant, she is a lesbian, she is living in a country where she doesn't speak the language. There's this big change happening in her life. And I guess I also want to play with people's preconceptions and prejudices. We know that women are trusted less than men. You know, they're very rarely invited onto television. We find out to give their viewpoint as experts. Pregnant women, people would say things like, is it your hormones running away with you? People do have prejudices against lesbians and gay people. So I guess to play with that, can we trust Jane? Perhaps there are good reasons why we might doubt what she's saying, but actually there's also good reasons why we might go with her.
It's interesting you say that, because without wanting to steer it too much down a sort of gender cul-de-sac, am I right in thinking this is your first novel with a woman protagonist? And why was she particularly suited to this story, do you think?
It had to be a woman at the centre of this book. The story is very much based, I guess, on the idea of the baby about to come as well. There's a sinister aspect to that too, I think. Many mothers worry about what are they going to produce? Will it be okay? Will they like this child? I don't know why. I guess for me the question is more, why hadn't I written a woman protagonist before? And I can honestly say that I don't know. I don't really know. So it was a great pleasure to be able to put a woman at the centre of this book. I think it's unfortunate if people limit themselves according to gender. So I think it is unfortunate if men think, I don't think I'll read that book because it's by a woman or because it involves pregnancy. I have a friend who teaches law, and she says when her class is on sex discrimination, often the male students will close their books and walk out because they think this does not apply to them. This is not a class that they need to listen to. And she calls them back and says, no, this is actually an issue that affects all of society. It's an issue that affects you as lawyers. So, you know, that kind of thing. Do men step up to the mark when it comes to gender, sexism, all of these things? Do they let the women go to the back of the bus, as I understand athletes during the Olympics did? You know, Australian athletes and I think Japanese athletes allowed their female colleagues to travel second class while they travelled first class. I think this wasn't
but still 1950s Alabama in the Olympics.
Across the board, but for some of the sports, this is what happened. So, you know, I think it's a shame if men think, I don't want to read a book because it's by a woman.
Why Berlin? I know that it had a supporting role in one of your earlier novels, and it's somewhere that you've lived before, but presumably you feel an affinity with it. Why? What is it about Berlin that makes it the perfect site for these kind of stories?
I think I'm increasingly interested in the way that we live in cities and the way that the past of cities encroaches on the present, and that goes for my city, which is Glasgow as well. I've just finished a series of sound works that explore Glasgow's connection with the North Atlantic slave trade. And there's a point in this book when Jane is talking about the war, the Second World War, to Petra, not at great length. It's an entertaining book, you know, there's not a lot of didacticism in it. But Petra says, so what about your city? What about your place? A city that's built on slavery and arms dealing. Is that okay? So I think Berlin is very rich, not only in its history, but in the way that it's confronted its history. And that interests me, I think.
You are in Edinburgh for the Books Festival, Louise, but you're also here for the premiere of an opera. This is Ghost Patrol, that you've written the libretto for.
I have. I wrote the words, and my friend Stuart McRae wrote the music, and it's being produced by Scottish Opera and Music Theatre Wales. And I'm so excited that actually I'm having difficulty sleeping already. I'm really, really, really excited. Maybe some of the same themes, perhaps, that are in The Girl on the Stairs are perhaps seeping through. But it's a very, very different piece. It involves two soldiers who meet again after about 5 years after the conflict, after they've left the army. There is still a war going on. The implication is there's possibly always going to be a war going on. Alistair is married to Vicky. Sam enters the scene, and I guess it's a classic triangle, and in the background there is a question about something that they did during the war. Was it right? Was it not right? Do they remember it the same? Is it worth? Should you dwell on these things, or should you just put them to the past? Do you have that choice? And perhaps that element of haunting and being haunted by the past is there still.
Louise Welsh's The Girl on the Stairs is published by John Murray. While fiction is the mainstay of the book festival, there's a continual debate going on in the tents around the Garden Square. Tonight, the Guardian debate is asking whether culture would lose its shine in an independent Scotland. And Majid Nawaz has come to launch his book, Radical, about how he first became a Muslim militant working for the organisation Hizb ut-Tahrir, but then after being imprisoned in Egypt, changed his views totally. He argues that his study of Arabic Islam convinced him that actually democracy is in fact the way to true Islam. He talked to our chief arts writer, Charlotte Higgins.
Majid, when you were a teenager and you were increasingly becoming more and more radicalised, and that was going on, you say, in a quite widespread way on London campuses, at universities and colleges, why did no one seem to pick up on it and stamp it out? What was the security services weren't interested?
So in the 90s... The UK was experiencing its heyday of Islamist activism, and there were many reasons for that. And you've touched upon one of them, which was that the establishment, the authorities, including the security services, weren't clamping down. And I'd go one step further and say that it was actually encouraged. And the reason it was encouraged is because in the 90s, the rise of Islamist extremism in Britain was in some way or the other seen as a foreign policy asset to exert control over foreign conflicts. Pretty much like the Afghan scenario with the Mujahideen there, that policy was being replicated domestically in Britain. So that's thankfully no longer the case, but that's why it's not just turning a blind eye. There were people that were actively encouraging the gathering of international Islamists in London.
And what did they want these Islamists to do?
Well, the intelligence services saw it as an intelligence asset, so they were able to monitor, they were able to intervene where necessary, but also leave to their own devices where necessary, so they could follow them. So in one sense, it was an intelligence asset. The other was that if you do intervene and you manage to exert a level of influence or control, it was seen as perhaps a level of influence or control over foreign conflicts where the UK interests may be jeopardised. But of course, the blowback from that was 7/7. It has a knock-on effect. And whenever you meddle in Islamist extremism or any other type of extremism in that way, then you must recognise that it will have a blowback. It did in Afghanistan. It did in Britain, and I'm worried that it will do in Syria now with what we've recently learnt of British jihadists who are there, who are responsible for kidnapping the British journalist.
What are your fears for Syria, if you could expand on that a bit?
My fears for Syria is that, and of course I support the removal of Assad, and have done since the beginning, and I've supported the removal of Mubarak and of Gaddafi. But there are two ways these things can go. They can either go the Egypt way, which is relatively peacefully, and Mubarak was then tried in a civil court and convicted, and incidentally is being held in the very same prison he held me in Egypt. It's a bit of poetic justice there, I suppose. But the other way it can go is the Gaddafi way, where the mob takes over, where it degenerates into tribalistic and sectarian violence, and that's where I'm worried about in Syria, because you've got an additional ingredient there, and that is that global jihadists are now fast migrating to the area on the Turkish-Syrian border, and are recruiting and are attempting to exploit what was a Syrian people's uprising for their own global ideological cause, and I hope they fail.
Majid, you were recruited to this cause and in your turn became a very effective recruiter and propagandizer for Hizb ut-Tahrir. But you're using those skills that you acquired to convince people of a cause now in a completely different way, aren't you? Could you tell us a bit about that?
So for 13 years, all I did was to recruit people to a revolutionary Islamist organization. I attempted to recruit army officers and civilians to this cause. And I know I can do that. So when I left the group, what I decided to do was I looked and I thought, well, these are transferable skills. Why not use the same skills, but instead of recruiting to Islamist extremism, recruit to democratic activism and organize young people along democratic lines? So create the Muslim Brotherhood equivalent of a democratic movement. And that's what I attempted to then do in Pakistan. So I founded a movement called Khudi, and it's a youth-led social movement. And its basic purpose is to do everything Islamist groups are doing with young people in these countries, but instead for democratic values. But we recognise that's a long-term process, and it's not something that's going to show results in 2 or 3 years. The Brotherhood were founded in Egypt in 1928. It took them until 2012 to win the presidential elections. This is what I call a civilizational debate, but the debate must be started.
Why do you think this might be a more effective route than the American foreign policy route, which has essentially been to try and present democracy to nations from outside?
Well, the neoconservative model had it upside down. What I believe is that you can't impose democratic values at the barrel of a gun. It's what I call the supply-led approach. If you want people to believe in values, then a belief, by definition, comes from inside. So what you need is what I call a demand-driven approach. And that's what I spoke about on the TED stage here in Edinburgh when I spoke and launched this idea of Khudi. And that is to create demand for democratic culture through grassroots activism rather than coming with guns and bombs and ships, which actually does more to turn people away from democratic values and pushes them towards the Islamist narrative of a clash of civilizations, when indeed there isn't a clash of civilizations, there's a clash of values which are cross-civilizational and cross-ethnicities. You know, there are non-Muslim dictators and there are Muslim dictators, and there are non-Muslim Democrats and there are Muslim Democrats. So why not unite people around these values on the grassroots to try and create a demand-driven approach within civil society for democratic culture? And what better place to start than Pakistan, where at the time we founded Khudi, it was most needed, and the Taliban had taken over large chunks of the country.
Could you explain what Khudi means? Excuse my bad pronunciation there.
Khudi is an Urdu and Persian term rooted in poetry, in the poetry of Allama Iqbal, who's one of the national poets of Pakistan. Linguistically, it simply means self-empowerment, self-realization, self-esteem. And so I think so much of extremism is born from insecurity and an identity crisis. And so calling it Khudi was, in fact, a reflection of our desire to encourage a more secure Pakistani identity. We want to replicate this model in other Muslim majority countries, but of course we will call the new movement, say in Libya or in Somalia, wherever we go next, we'll use a name that's suitable to that country.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.